Now, here we are. This is, if you want the citation, it's the Antiquities, chapter 8. He says this. Now, this is Agrippa the First. You got this? Agrippa the First, who beheaded James, and whose death is told about in Acts 12. Right?
Right.
Okay. He says this. Now, when Agrippa had reigned 3 years over all Judea, see, it was restored to him by who? Caligula. Restored to the Rhodian family, given to him. He came to the city, Caesarea, and there he had been chosen the honor of Caesar. And Luke tells in Acts 12 about Caesarea putting on these shows. On the second day of which shows, he put on the garment made holy of silver. And did you cover this when you took state acts? I don't want to. He put this garment made holy of silver and of a contexture truly wonderful. And as he made this garment so it would reflect light. And he came to the theater early in the morning, at which time the silver of his garment being illuminated by the fresh reflection of the sun's rays upon it shone out after a surprising manner. What he did was, he was going to put on a show. So he gets this garment that reflects light, and he gets on the edge up on top of this big amphitheater at Caesarea, and he stands so that when the sun comes up over the Judean mountains to the east, here, at the east, it would shine directly upon this garment and reflect light. People would be dazzled by it. What does Luke said? They said the voice of God, not of the man. It was exactly the effect he wanted to produce. It was quite a show. Anyway, it spread, and was so resplendent as to spread a horror over those that looked intently upon him. And presently his flatterers cried out from one place, another from another, and then Josephus adds, though not for his good, as we're going to see later, that he was a god. See, Luke records it, the god. And they added, be thou merciful to us, for although we have hitherto reverenced thee as only as a man, shall we henceforth own thee as a superior to mortal nature. Now I'm going to look to you as a god. Upon this the king did neither rebuke them nor reject their impious flattery. But as he presently afterwards looked up, he saw an owl. This was supposed to be an omen of his death and his birth. A severe pain arose in his belly. He began in the most violent manner. He there, and all of a sudden, and Herod knows, something tells him this is it. He therefore looked upon his friends and said, I, whom you call a god, and commanded presently to depart this life. He said, I think I bought it. While providence thus reproves the lying words you just now said to me, and I, who was by you called immortal, am immediately to be hurried away by death. You call me a god, now you're going to find out how ungodlike I am. I'm about to die. He probably didn't say this. Josephus probably made the speech up for him. Because, to show that he learned his lesson too late. And he wasn't a god. Now, maybe he actually said it, but not like Herod's saying there. So that's one of the problems with Josephus' speeches. And we thought a man should have made a speech, he usually gave him one. When he said this, his pain was become violent. Accordingly, he was carried to the palace, and the rumor went abroad everywhere that he was certainly dying in a little time. But the multitude presently set in sackcloth with their wives and children under the law of their country, and besought God for the king's recovery. The most insincere praying of all time. Lord, please help him get well. If you really want to. Anyway. All places were also full of mourning and lamentation. This was official mourning. Now the king rested in the high chamber, and as he saw them below lying prostrate on the ground, he could not himself forbear weeping. Here's all these professional mourners down there weeping. He got in the spirit of the thing. He started crying too. Maybe I wasn't such a bad guy. And when he had been quite worn out by the pain in his belly for 5 days, he departed his life, being in the 54th year of his age and the 7th year of his reign. Now this, you got this? I mentioned it because this is the Herod, who was the one, Agrippa the First, who beheaded James. Agrippa the Second, his son, formed Paul of here, but preached the gospel. Okay, you got that? Herod the Great, birth of Jesus. Herod Antipas, governor of Galilee, king of Galilee, before Jesus was tried. Agrippa the First, beheaded James. Death is told in Acts 12. Agrippa the Second, before Paul appears. Now you can't, we go through this because you just read the scripture, you don't know this, you can't tell. You have to get this map out of information. Yes.
Josephus doesn't say that he was eaten by worms, doesn't he?
No, he said it pained his belly.
Yeah.
Herod the Great, the one I didn't make, well, I had marked, I mean, I stuck the paper in, I didn't, don't have time to read it. Herod the Great, when he died, he realized everybody hated him, nobody was going to love him. So what he did, he had the leaders of Jerusalem, the leaders of Judea, the natural Jewish leaders, brought into the amphitheater, locked in, and the archers sent in, and he sent with the order given that when you're driven, I'm dead, you kill all these men, by several hundred, so that there'll be mourning in Jerusalem. He knew, you know, the old story of the old king of Amos and Andy, used to be on the radio. Must have asked Kingfish one time, said, Kingfish, you can't have life insurance? He said, no, sir. He didn't have no life insurance, because when he died, he was going to sing in the street. And Herod knew that as soon as he died, you know, it was going to be the most very insincere mourning, because he was going to be singing in the streets. But he just couldn't tolerate the idea of the Jews celebrating when he died, so he ordered the leaders of the nation slaughtered at his death so that he would be sure there'd be mourning. Yeah, great weeping in the city when he died. He didn't care for him or not, just as long as nobody was laughing. You can see why the scriptures say when Herod trembled, all Jerusalem trembled with him. I mean, a fellow do that, kill his own son, kill his own wife, you know, pull a trick like that. I mean, when he got upset, he told nobody's liable to do. So when they heard Herod was upset, the whole city became alive. Okay? Well, much more to be, yes.
Everybody gets blind from their own, that all the people have to do about it, and then when he dies, he gets a good order.
Pardon?
From after Herod was the first died, he gave the order.
Well, because there were those who were lost, and you see, his successor was coming out. He had to live with his son, Archelaus. Well, there's much more to be said. I just hit the high points, but I don't have time to develop all the story of Herod. It's very complicated. But I simply want you to be able to identify the Herod that you read in the New Testament. You know, and to understand why that there is a Herod who is king of Jerusalem when Jesus is born. There is a Herod who is king of Jerusalem when James is beheaded. Book of Acts, early the book of Acts. But there's no Herod who is king of Jerusalem in Jerusalem at the trial of Jesus. But during that brief period, Judea came under the governor because of the misrule of Archelaus. Later on in your story, we'll get to first. Okay? Yeah.
What did you say that Herod did? Is the battle in Spain?
I don't know. I just had a thought. I don't know. Did you mean that?
Okay.
Huh? These were puppet kings. They were.
Why is it here to answer the Bible and he was thinking of the
law? Agrippa? Well,
seems like he was a person.
No, well, see, he didn't have jurisdiction. He was. Now, really, you had this Herod Agrippa II. Now, the story behind that. See, he appears, Agrippa the First received the rule. But again, this was constantly being changed. See, Rome was overseeing this. Rome was in charge. And actually, I didn't go into this, but since you raised it, let me say this a minute ago. Agrippa the Second, before whom Paul stood, he was a king without portfolio. He wore the title king. He was allowed by the Romans to be king. But actually, the Romans had, for all practical purposes, given the rule back to the governor. He was allowed to wear the title, but more, and he had some honors and responsibilities. But really, for this Agrippa, it was an honorary title for the most part. It was kind of like, at this point, he's like the king of England. He's not in charge, you know. The king reigns, but he does not rule. And by Agrippa II, he reigned, but did not rule. It was more than anything else an honorary title. Because of our time limitation, I did just want you to be able to identify the Herod that you read about in the New Testament. Okay. I'm going to skip Judea under Roman governor 6, because I don't want to talk about it. And no, we covered we're kind of being pressed by time, and I really don't think it's all that important, and I covered what I consider the salient points in our discussion of the Herods. And also you have some information on the government and the chronological outline I gave you. We're going to have a quiz on Monday.
Let's have a Tuesday, please.
How many want to have a Tuesday instead of Monday?
Wednesday.
I'm going to have a Monday.
Oh,
Monday, when?
Yeah,
25 votes, right? Oh, I don't care. Tuesday's okay. It will be over the quiz now, over the Caesars, the Herodian succession, and what we're going to cover today. Okay? We go over the Caesars, the Roman emperors, over the Herodian succession that we discussed yesterday, and what we cover today. Today we're going to finish this section today. Look down at Roman numeral 7, the Messianic cult. Now, this is, in my opinion, a very important subject. By the way, I think your textbook has a whole chapter on it, Bruce. And we begin by pointing out that the Old Testament predicted that the Messiah was going to come. Excuse me, I have a voice trouble today. My voice is out, we're going to have a sharp blast. So you all pray for me. Even though you can pray, I'm not able to finish class anyway. the age of the prophets brought more specific predictions about this Messiah. In the age of the prophets, there emerged two vivid particulars concerning the Messiah when he should come. In the book of Daniel, we have the concept that the Messiah, when he's going to come, he is going to be like David. Although this language is used in the Psalms, and this prophecy is certainly in the older sections of the Old Testament, but specifically, Daniel prophesied that in the days of the Fourth Empire, that is in the days of the Roman Empire, the Messianic kingdom would be set up, and it would stand in contrast to the worldly kingdoms such as Babylon, Persian, Greece, and Rome. Because this kingdom would be divine in origin. It would be, for instance, the great image of the great vision of the image, a stone cut out of the mountain, not with hands, comes down, the crest of the image. It would be divine in origin, and then it would never end. The Messianic kingdom. The Jews thought much about this. And the last question, the disciples ever asked Jesus on earth was, "Will thou at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" Okay? Also in the age of the prophets, there emerges this concept that this Messiah will also be a redeemer. Isaiah 53. By his stripes we are healed. He was wounded for our transgression. He was bruised for our iniquity. The chastisement of our peace, that is peace with God, was upon him. And by his stripes we are healed. Now, he's going to function in a priestly way. He's going to function in a royal way. Redemption and rule, if you want to divide it that way. Y'all see that? So you have a two-pronged emphasis. You have the concept, the Messianic concept, coming to focus on two points. He is going to redeem, as Isaiah said. He is going to rule. Now, I just use Isaiah and Daniel as an example. That's certainly not exclusive to these prophets. I mean, these ideas were early. They are just made more explicit by the prophets. Now, the Jews had a tough time understanding how a Messiah could both redeem, could come and die. He is led like a sheep to the slaughter. They worry about this. They struggle with this. When our Messiah comes, if he's going to come to set up a Jewish world empire, if he's going to restore the glory of David's kingdom, is going to come and once again make of Israel a glorious nation and rule over them. How can he do that and die? It seemed to be antithetical ideas. Interesting, what text was the Ethiopian eunuch struggling with as he was going back home? Isaiah 53. Who did he speak, of himself or some other man? This text received much attention. Now, you remember in our discussion of the Dead Sea Scroll, this is a reflection of a cult or a sect of Judaism in the intertestamental period. You recall our discussion of the fact that they had worked out a way to solve this dilemma, how he could come and rule at the same time he comes and dies. And what was it? Right. Remember the Dead Sea story here, the concept that really the Old Testament did not prophesy one Messiah. It prophesied two Messiahs. One would be the priestly Messiah. One would be the Davidic or the royal Messiah. One would come and die, and then following one would come to reign. Now it's interesting that there is in the Talmud, and with the Talmud it's difficult always to see how old these ideas were and are, but the Talmud, even though it's in its edited, written form, is certainly post-Christian, about 8500, yet it reflects many ideas that are pre-Christian, and so it's difficult to say, but the fact remains that in the Talmud, regardless of how old this idea is, in the Talmud you also find the concept of two Messiahs. Did you know that? The Talmud, now this may be post-Christian. That is, it may be because the Christians pose such a challenge to come up this theory. Or it may be pre-Christian, and the fact that we find this same idea in the Qumran documents indicates that it could be pre-Christian. So, regardless of where we come down in time for all of Judaism, we are on safe ground in affirming, recognizing the fact that the Jews, that one of the ways that they saw this dilemma was, they came up with the concept of two Messiahs. Now, how many Jews held that idea and when is very problematic. But it's interesting that this illustrates for us, makes vivid this problem that they have of understanding what the Old Testament said. Secondly with this, though, first of all, they saw the dilemma in their own minds. Some of the Jews did at various times by saying, well, there were two Messiahs. Found it in the Dead Sea Scrolls, found it in the Talmud. We know the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, are pre-Christian. The Talmudic idea, a little less certain. Yes?
What gave them the idea that it wasn't trying to be a spiritual thing? In other words, why did they...
Because the language of the Old Testament, if you take it literally, physically, you would conclude that when the Messiah came, he was going to set up a Jewish world empire. He would rule over Israel, Israel would rule the world, or Israel would. This would be the eternal messianic kingdom.
Wasn't there any way that they would have known it was meant spiritual?
Yes, but there are many signs in the Old Testament, hints, that it was not to be a physical kingdom at all. Like the temple of the messianic kingdom. Like Ezekiel's temple, obviously not a physical temple. The old thing of it's hyperbolic language, exaggerated dimensions to indicate the extreme glory of it. But no one believed that it was those dimensions, it was out of proportion, way too big, and Gentiles were to serve as priests in the temple. You see, obviously it was not simply one more Jewish temple. So there were signals which they many often ignore. It's like, that's what you have in Revelation. It's silly to think that the holy city in Revelation is a literal city. It's not. But it's a cube. And the first thing to know by reading that is, it's way out of proportion, that it's figurative. It's a figurative description of the glorious of the church glorifying. This is high, this is wide. Well, that's not beautiful. Call me? Cube. Well, anyway. So the verse signals that they ignore them.
Yes. Wouldn't it be hard to look at a spiritual thing, especially with the situation they're in?
Yes, very good point. You know what he's saying? Well, I'll put it in my own words. What John is suggesting is that they I'm sorry. They were an oppressed people. First oppressed by the Assyrians, then by the Babylonians, then by the Greeks, and then by the Romans. And they would naturally long for their turn to be in charge. Their Messiah, there were the Jews would tend to say this, okay, you can pomp on us now, but you wait till our Messiah gets here. You're going to get yours. Then we're going to see who runs the prison and who's in it. Then we're going to see who's the master and who's the slave. What they tended to do, this brought me up to my second point, they tended to deal with or respond to this dual concept of the Messiah by either two Messiahs, or they tended to ignore the priestly element for the reason that you gave them. They tended to ignore this and emphasize this. When he comes, he's going to rule. Here's what very common. When you talk about a Jewish belief, this, in the first century, there was no such thing as Judaism. There were Judaisms. Expressions of Judaism. The second, there was no such thing as a Jewish concept. There were concepts held by various Jews. But a common Jewish concept was that every Jew who was born, who was Abraham, that is, would automatically be a part of the Messianic kingdom. Being born of Abraham made you a part of the kingdom. And of course, I talked here about the fact, this is the background of the discussion of Jesus with Nicodemus, of course. Did I talk about that again? See, Nicodemus says, we know you're a teacher come from God, no man can do these things, but God will. But you see, Jesus claiming to be the Messiah, yet he wasn't acting the way a Messiah was supposed to act. What Nicodemus was really asking is, since you're the Messiah, where's your kingdom? Where's the kingdom? So Jesus begins to instruct him on what the kingdom is really like. He says, you've been born of Abraham, that's fine. That doesn't fit anywhere. You've got to be born again to get in my kingdom. That which is born of flesh is flesh, but you'll be born of the Spirit, see. Well, anyway, and often, you see, when one of the emotional forces undergirding the Maccabean revolt was Messianic hope. The idea that the Jews were going to be led to establish a Jewish world empire. Where Israel would be preferred. Now, that didn't work out. The Zealot movement, when they saw Jesus performing the miracles, they realized that, anybody can feed a crowd of, which numbers 5,000 men, besides women and children, with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Think about it. Wouldn't he be a great quartermaster for an army? When they saw him raise Lazarus from the dead, they said, wow, anybody can take dead men and make them alive? She had no trouble taking the live men and making them dead. He's very good, and they kept trying to make him they kept trying to get him to go to Jerusalem and set up this temporal world empire. You see, that's the background. You understand, for instance, the triumphal entry. The crowd had rejected Jesus for a whole year, mainly because he wouldn't come near Jerusalem. And the temple leaders had said, if he comes, we're going to kill him. So when they finally the word spread that he's coming to Jerusalem, here's what they were saying. Well, this is it. He's either going to set up this empire or he's going to be dead. And since he's coming, what they shout, Hosanna to the son of David. Now he's going to come to Jerusalem and set up this throne, destroy the Romans. That's why when he didn't do that, he rode in on a donkey and they'd be all ready for him, you see. When he refused to do that, the same voices were crying a day and a half later, crucify him. And Judas betrayed him and said, forget it. Now, this is so much in the background of the New Testament. This is very much a part of the world of the New Testament. And that's what this class, of course, is about. That's why, for instance, when Jesus said, you turn the other cheek, they said, wait a minute. It's not our Messiah talking. When our Messiah comes, it'll be somebody else's turn to turn the other cheek. But that had to go ahead today. I didn't cut into your schedule too much. I had the class. Basically, this is the idea that crucified Jesus as far as the Jews were concerned. They said, well, what was the charge they brought against him? Blasphemy. I mean, the Romans, what did they put over his...
King of the Jews.
King of the Jews. Now, later on, and this idea, by the way, led to the destruction of the Jewish state. Remember Jesus said in Matthew 24, many false Christs are going to arise. Do not go after them. They're going to say, go here, go there. He said, don't do it. Don't go after them. Why? Well, that's not me. Now, these false Christs did arise, and they presented themselves as the Messiah and said, and they did exactly, or claimed that, said that they were going to do exactly what the zealots tried to get Jesus to do, and that is to lead in a revolt against Rome. Send them and believe that God would miraculously intervene and they would establish their empire. Now, this is about, and so Jesus warns about this. For instance, we read in Josephus, he's talking about the fall of Jerusalem, and he said it, and the events leading up to it, he said this, as the city is being destroyed, a false prophet was the occasion of these people's destruction. Who had made a public, this prophet had made a public proclamation of the city that very day that God commanded them to get up on the temple, and that there they should receive miraculous signs of their deliverance. Now, there was then a great number of false prophets suborned by the tyrants to impose upon the people who denounced this to them. They should wait for deliverance from God. And this was in order to keep them from deserting, that they might be buoyed up above fear and care by such hopes. That is, the false prophets were bribed to keep the people from leaving, fleeing, and staying there expecting miraculous deliverance. Because they thought this was the messianic hope. Thus were the miserable people persuaded by these deceivers, and such as belied God himself. While they did not attend or give credit to the signs that were so evident, and did so plainly foretell their future desolation, but like men infatuated, without either eyes to see or minds to consider. But anyway, the point is that there was a widespread idea all through this period that now God is going to establish, give the kingdom back to Israel. Tacitus, for instance, records knowledge of this idea. Very interesting. He says this. Talk about the Jews now. Now this is a pagan Roman historian, late first century Roman historian. Prodigies as unusual events that had occurred with this nation, that is the Jews, prone to superstition, but hating all religious rites, did not deem it lawful to expiate by offering and sacrifice. There had been seen hosts joining battle in the sky, the fiery gleam of arms, the temple illuminated by sudden radiance from the clouds. These were stories that were going around this period. The doors of the inner shrine were suddenly thrown open, and a voice with more than mortal tone was heard to cry that the gods were departing. The same instant there was a mighty stir as of departure. Some people put a fearful meaning on these events. But in most, there was a firm persuasion that in the ancient records of the priests was contained a prediction, the ancient records of their priests, that the Old Testament. In the ancient records of their priests was contained a prediction of how at this very time the East was to grow powerful and rulers coming from Judea were to acquire universal empire. Tacitus, the reference is Histories, Book 5, 13. Histories 5, 13. Interesting. So Tacitus, this idea was so popular with the Jews that the non-Jews knew about it. Suetonius, also, and what this reference is under Vespasian 4-5. Now Vespasian was the emperor who was ruling when Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. He said this. Y'all got that? Vespasian was the ruler. He followed Nero. Well, he didn't. There were three: Otho, Gabellius, and Otho Galban and Vitellius were three minor kings that ruled in between Nero and Vespasian. But they just ruled for a few weeks. They did not really hold it, so they didn't reign. In AD 70, Vespasian was the emperor. He says this: an ancient superstition was current in the East that out of Judea would come the rulers of the world. This tradition, as later proved, he said, referred to two Roman emperors, Vespasian and his son Titus. Titus was the general who destroyed in the city of Jerusalem. But anyway, the point is that both Tacitus and Suetonius and Josephus, all three, reflect this ancient Jewish conviction that when the Messiah came, that the Jews were going to rule the world. You can see why they would have such a hard time accepting a humble Redeemer who would die for them. Can't you? I mean, if their Redeemer was going to come, if their Messiah was going to come and overthrow Rome, mighty Rome, he was certainly going to have to be tougher than Rome. The one thing he could not do was come and be humble and die. In other words, they said, when my Messiah comes, he's going to kill the Romans. But what happened? Romans killed him. One of the reasons why the Jews rejected the gospel, this idea was firmly planted in their minds, through a selective reading of the Old Testament, through a misreading of the Old Testament, mainly through prejudice and desire for glory. And people like this. That's why, for instance, when Jesus came preaching meekness and humility, even John the Baptist, when he was in prison, sent his messengers, some of his friends, disciples, to say what to Jesus?
Are you the one?
And you stand. The basic proposition in all this is what Jesus told Pilate. Pilate asked him about this, didn't he? You're a king. What did Jesus say?
My kingdom
is not of this world. It's interesting. You go through the book of Acts. I wish we had time to do this. If you look in the book of Acts, you find the preaching in the book of Acts, preaching the church now, the kingdom of God, focuses not upon the Redeemer, but upon the rule, on the Davidic rule. Peter, who does Peter preach about first? David.
Yes.
You look at that. And this is the book of Revelation that sounds exactly like that, by the way. They went about, look at this, look the language that Luke uses. They went about preaching the kingdom of God. All the prophets were about these days, the kingdom, preaching the church. And Paul writes, thanks be to God who has transcended us from the kingdom of darkness into what? The kingdom of his dear son. Now, note this. We understand this idea was, the solution to the idea was not to ignore, was not to posit two messiahs, as many did. I don't know how many, I've said. You got that? Either two messiahs, or simply ignore the priestly redeemer messiah, and remember and focus and enlarge upon the Davidic rule. The solution is in the gospel. That he died for us and he became the ruler of a spiritual kingdom, the church. And notice, the New Testament calls calls the church Israel. It calls Christians the temple. Now we understand, don't we, how Ezekiel, for instance, could say that in this new temple, Gentiles would offer sacrifices. Because we are Gentiles, most of us. That's all. We offer sacrifices, don't we? And that Paul could write to the Galatians, calling the church the Israel of God, the true Israel. And Paul could explain in Romans that Israel is not the Israel of the flesh, but Israel of faith. It always has been, by the way, there. Now we understand this, that that in the days of the fourth empire, the days of the Roman Empire, as Daniel predicted, that the kingdom was set up, called the church, kingdom of God. New Testament is very clear about this. Jesus is very clear about it. But old ideas die hard. And so the Jews continue with the concept that, well, there's going to be two messiahs, that they find the battalion. But I maintain that if you don't understand what the Jews were struggling with, you do not understand much of Jesus' ministry. There's going to be big gaps in our understanding. This is the idea, as far as the Jews were concerned, that eventually put Jesus on the cross. You see? They said, like Nicodemus, we know you're from God, but you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're the Messiah. They kept trying to get him to establish this Jewish world empire. Yes.
This book behind Jesus' statement when he talked about telling them to believe, this kind of whole thing, where it's going to be this barrier that they put up.
Yes. Then they came to Jerusalem one time. Because they were coming to Jerusalem, Jesus told them this parable about a man who received the kingdom and went to a far country to receive it, ruled in absentia. He was personally absent, ruled through his representatives. Time and time again, the kingdom of heaven is like. Why did he emphasize? The kingdom of heaven is like a man who goes out and throws a net in the sea. And the separation of the good from the bad. The kingdom of heaven is like, well, see, they believe that when Messiah came, that would destroy all evil, the universal peace, with the Jews as the preferred race and the master race. They're in charge. Universal peace. No more evil. So Jesus says, it's not that at all. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who goes out and sows seed in the field, and his enemy comes and sows tares. And what do they do? Let both grow together until the harvest. Both evil and good will coexist until the harvest. The kingdom parables are all, or almost all, in direct refutation of this notion. He pounds at it. The spiritual kingdom. That God could have set up a rule by supernatural intimidation anytime he wanted to. But his is the rule of love. It's a very basic concept. To show you how hard the idea died, the night that Jesus was crucified, Peter still was carrying the sword. Just in case. And what did Jesus say to him? Peter, cut off the ear of the high priest. I think it's ridiculous. Peter was not a sword, he was a fisherman. Didn't know how to use it, so he used it like a chopping axe, I think. Came straight across then the guy's head, and the guy moved that thing, what did it do? It dropped the deer. He says, in fact, now Peter, if we're going to do business like that, I don't need one stiff-armed fisherman defending me with one sword, doesn't always win the war. All I've got to do is say the word, and I'll have what? I have 10 legions of angels here to know what they're doing. I mean, if I'm going to do it that way, I don't need you. Well, you know, anyway, I'll get 10 legions of angels who are good at it. We'll do it right. That's pretty. I think it's hilarious. I think you just smile when you say that. You're standing there, ready to back up. But you see, it wasn't to be done that way. Need I say more about my point? Other night, we can just go through the gospel narrative and just see almost every page is conflict. Jesus is talking about it. Now, the last thing I would say is about this idea. This problem the idea that Jesus is, there's really two messiahs, and this way of thinking that emphasizes the royal aspect and ignores this pretty much, is still a very popular idea. In fact, most evangelicals still hold it. It's like a version of it. You see, the New Testament teachers made it very plain that there's only one Messiah, and that in the church, his ministry as Redeemer and as ruler are combined under Jesus Christ, our Redeemer and our Lord, died for us and runs our life. He's combined. He's combined. However, this idea, a very durable idea that the Jews had, the idea to crucify Jesus as far as the Jews were concerned about saying for it. Now there's a slight modification of it around today. It's not that Jesus was, that there's two messiahs, but there's two kingdoms. That Jesus came the first time and set up a kingdom, not really talked about in the Old Testament, which he ruled as Redeemer. But when he comes back, then he's going to set up the Messianic Kingdom, the Davidic Kingdom, ruled from Jerusalem, over Jewish World Empire. A popular view. You look like that kind of earth, and think about it. Most, all Assemblies of God teach it. 99% of all the Baptist churches teach it. About a third of our churches teach it. And you think, a very good book on the subject, it's called the New Testament. so that the idea that the church is not, the church was not mentioned, the most systematic explanation of this is in the footnotes of the Scopio Reference Bible. That the church is not really the kingdom. It's a kingdom in some sense, but it's not the Messianic Kingdom. That when Jesus comes back, then he's going to establish the Messianic Kingdom promised in Daniel. Then he's going to go to Jerusalem. And he's going to conquer down all the enemies. World, or universe, he's going to save all the Jews. And a universal world of peace. Well, this concession of the premillennialism is very popular view. And it's still the view of the crucified Jesus, and it's still heresy and blasphemy and unbelief. It teaches that. And so, for instance, what they try to do is get all the props back on the stage to give Jesus another chance to do it right this time. You know, revive it to, Daniel said the days of the fourth empire, and Rome was the fourth empire, so you got to revive the Roman Empire, get it back on the stage, rebuild the temple, and get the nation, get national Israel back on the scene, and reinstitute animal sacrifice, and get everything going again like you had before, and then Jesus is going to come and try it again. Now, most evangelicals hold it, by the way. If you get your radio preacher, the 9 out of 10 is over. But it's popular. The majority of you. And preachers like it. Talk about Armageddon. So this idea, you got that in the place where somebody said there's two kingdoms. He came once, and now he's going to come back. When he comes back, then he'll set up the Messianic Kingdom. Reign and miracle from Jerusalem.
And then Matthew 24:25, he talks about his return. He talks about the signs first. And then
no, the signs are not for the signs are for the destruction of Jerusalem. The signs are actually for not for the return.
But then he says, "Sign of the sun, man, coming in the clouds."
That he's talking. That's what. That is all has to do with the early history of the church. We analyze it carefully. This is the study of gospels. You see, all somebody said that Jesus, it's impossible for Jesus to have given signs for his return because he didn't know anything like that.
Does
he care about the same ground? Well, anyway, what I want us to see is, another hand back here.
Did the Romans take this idea of a world ruler as a real threat?
Yes. You see, the Romans never quite understood what the Christians were saying. That's why, in my opinion, the book of Revelation was written in symbolic language.
Could this be one of the reasons that brought about such a total destruction of Jerusalem?
Possibly.
To make sure they won't come back?
Yeah, possibly.
They didn't do about it. The Jews have been very plain. They said to everybody, when our Messiah comes, the Jews are going to rule the world. But you see, what, in other words, this concept of dividing into two, you have to. In other words, if you're not going to accept it, if you're not going to accept the idea, listen to me, if you do not accept the idea that the church is the Messianic kingdom, probably the Messianic kingdom of Daniel, don't accept that idea. Then you've got to divide it up some way. You either got to have two Messiahs, or two kingdoms, one prophesied and one not. And you've got to have two peoples. It's a very popular idea today that God does not have one people, he has two peoples. He's got the church and he's got
the Jews.
And the New Testament doesn't blow that idea into a cock head. It doesn't talk about anything. But God only has one people. There's no distinction. Either Jew and Greek, bond or free, broken down the middle of all partition, God has no respecter of persons. Included all in unbelief that he might have grace upon all. Time and time again, that God only has one people, and one kind of salvation, one Messiah, one way, by grace through faith. No other way. But you see, you understand what I'm saying? But this debate, they divide it up in two peoples, two kingdoms, and it's very, very deadly. By the way, this idea is the grandfather, the father, either the father, the grandfather, the great-grandfather of most of the cults. This idea was first preached broadly in America by a man called William Miller. And when his prediction didn't come true, one group of his followers became the Seventh-day Adventists. Another group of his followers became the Jehovah's Witnesses. And one group of the Adventists, the seedbed from which sprang Prince of the Armstrong Knights.
What you got?
And the Mormons also sprang from this kind of stuff. And there are hundreds of preachers who will stand out and tell you, if you don't believe in this, but that when Jesus comes back, then he's going to set up the kingdom. He is going to be violent. Scopius had what's called a mystery parenthesis theory. It's a parenthesis. The main focus of the Jews. The church is a parenthesis stuck into mystery. It was an unprophesied interruption. The church, the Sophia Bible, which most of the Baptists think was directly inspired, the King James Bible footnotes. The King James is the only inspired English version, and the footnotes are almost inspired. He teaches that the church was an unprophesied, unpromised, unpredicted interruption in God's plan. Or a mystery parenthesis, is what he means by unpredictable mystery. Parenthesis, interruption, inside. You go out and preach to people, and as you get to people's homes, you're going to do business with this idea. Why don't you understand where it comes from? Historical background. It goes all the way. It's a very old idea. And it comes, why does it live on? Well, for the Jews, it was so durable because, you see, the Jews thought that the Jews knew that they were the chosen people, didn't they? But they thought that they were chosen to rule. And they weren't. They were chosen to serve. And when Jesus said, presented him this opportunity, they won't at least be interested in that. It's more fun to rule than it is to serve, by the way. He who would be the greatest among you must be servant of all. And unless they even pass the switch on, these pagans got the idea that, the Jews are born to rule. Okay, master race, first race. Any questions? I don't know. I think I have so many things to say about it, but this is the only day I can get to it. I'll have to do the days. Have any questions they're asking now? My question is, do you understand what I talked about today?
Mm-hmm.
It's
an important lecture in that, even though I just gave it the broadest outline. But let me rehead. I want us to see that this idea is very much a part of the New Testament world. In my opinion, it's impossible to understand the gospel narrative unless you understand this is what was going on. And that it was such a problem that's reflected in the three primary sources for our period, in Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius. Such a wide idea. And the idea of two messiahs, both in the Talmud and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it's very persistent in a different, in a modified form. It dominates evangelical Christianity today. It dominates.
If the royal king of David was so common to the other church, and he was one of the tests of written towards that, well, why is the moron going for the priestly function? Why is he more of the priestly aspect?
In the New Testament? There is. I said the book of Acts when I said the preaching.
Well, even Paul's
writing. Well, no, Paul gives it both. Peter does too. Look, you know, Hebrews, for instance, fully develops the priestly function. And Paul develops the book of Romans. Oh, man. Now that for one man dies for the whole, you know, and Adam all died and Christ also went. One man dies for the whole nation concept. I never said the preaching is the book of Acts. It emphasizes the David's kingdom, the kingdom aspect, more than the priestly aspect. That's what I think the book of Acts, the preaching in the book of Acts. I didn't mean in the writing, the New Testament.
Did they kind of go along with that view today? Did they consider
the death of Jesus in that? They would say no, but logically, you would say yes. And you see, a part of this idea is that you have, see, what they say is, well, we take the Old Testament literally. Well, they don't. They take certain parts pretty much convenient. But if you insist on that, you get all kinds of stupidity. For instance, Scofield teaches this Bible, which is, you know, supposed to be the holy. It's just the King James Bible. He teaches that when Jesus comes back, that the temple is going to be rebuilt and animal sacrifices are once again going to be offered. Now, all dispensationalists and primitives don't teach that, but most of them do. Some who teach it don't teach it too loud. I mean, if you can read the book of Hebrews, you don't believe that when Jesus comes back, that animal sacrifice is going to be reinstituted. You got a problem. And citizens, these fellows who claim to be so, take the Bible so literally, citizens, they can't find it. Little boy, through the Bible. What's his name? I live in here. What's his name? Yeah, J. Vernon McGee. I listened to him for years. Loved the great delivery. This man. He said, this little boy, he can't find the church in Daniel. You can't find the church in Isaiah. The church is not in the prophets. And the fundamental thing is the church is not in the prophets. Guess where he finds the church? He finds the church in the Song of Solomon. Now, brother, if you can't find the church in Daniel, but you can find the Song of Solomon, you got a tougher prejudice than anything I've ever seen. Pardon? Yeah, Thompson Chain, yes, that's exactly right. Yes. Well, I don't know, but different Jews think different things. The Jews are interested in rebuilding the temple, by the way. He's not the one from Israel.
Is there anything written like after 70 A.D. with the Jews kind of thought after it all?
Well, this idea did not die. See, it was a tough idea. And many of the church fathers who were Jewish, and some who weren't, were caught up in this idea. Oh, some of them. It was a tough idea, yeah.
Is it true that they thought, too, on the lines of if they were good Jews, they would have the conquering Messiah, and if they were, you know, not so good, they would have the other type of Messiah that wasn't.
I'd never come across that. I wouldn't be surprised.
This is the Jews for Jesus, and what they call themselves believers. I don't think they've really come to the baptism, but they call themselves believers. They hold this view that. And they're Jews today. They believe that Jesus is the Christ. And I heard one of them teaching that that they had the Messiah, Joseph ben David, and you know, this back and forth work. They had the idea that the concept of the two messiahs.
Yes. There's many, and you pointed to a thing, there are many versions of this. Mm-hmm. Two messiahs, two kingdoms. They separate the priestly function. Here's what you get, the first time Lenten teaches. Jesus came first time to be our Redeemer. When he comes back, he's going to be our Lord. The Bible doesn't say that. He comes back, he's going to be our judge. The Lord is our Lord now, isn't he?
This
is how
we're
going
to do this.
Yes.
You remember.
Jesus
or not,
they
Jesus.
Is that Jesus
for
the first time,
for the Gentiles? I don't mean versions of this. This is helpful to you.
This is a very, very important subject. This is what I think is causing so much division in the Christian churches, because you're going to find that there's so many people that believe everything up to the point, and then when you come to the second coming of Christ, they think he's actually coming to this.
You should be getting a copy of the the reading assignment. When you get this, you get a reading assignment of Christ around Newsweek. There's a file folder in the reserve shelf. It's got at least three copies. Yeah, so this week to read it. I'll be with this week. And there's three sets of notes that I'll read it. It's short, and the three copies, I don't think the class this size should have much trouble and having access to read it. Okay? I'm sore throat today. I want you to call a martyr. Suffering for the cause. I'm getting a little thing to drink out of, keep going. Every time he took a drink, his speech was a little more slurred. I'm going to give you back the test. Let's cover it. We're going to talk about Jesus in Palestine, and this material we're going to talk about first, the discovery of ancient Palestine in your outline. This as well been included in the last section on Palestine. Perhaps next time I teach it, I probably will. So it doesn't make any difference. I'll get my final teach it a few more times. We'll talk a bit about the discovery of ancient Palestine, a lesson perhaps in archaeology, and this is very important, especially to a history course. Archaeology is the handmaiden of history. It's the job of the archaeologist to produce data in a systematic way. It's the job of the historian to interpret that data and to correlate it with other data to put together a comprehensive picture of the history of the period. So the relationship of a historian and archaeologist is this: the archaeologist produces the raw material, and the historian correlates this raw material to a reconstructed picture of a period. And so it's important that we talk about archaeology. Archaeology is a really new science. I've made it say before, I'm very much interested in it, but I didn't think that preaching the gospel was more important than I would be an archaeologist. Fascinating field, which is opening up. Palestine archaeology is a comparatively new thing. New things are happening all the time. But you see, Palestine was ruled for 1,000 years by the Muslims.
Muslims had no interest in archaeology, traditionally, or their systems had not been interested in archaeology. There was no care given to preserve the holy sites, except a very few. Dome of the Rock, the Mosque of Omar sits on Dome of the Rock, where Abraham theoretically offered Isaac, and Abraham was a great figure to the Muslims, and they preserved that. But as far as excavating and sites, they had little interest. During the Middle Ages, Jerusalem at one time was occupied by the Crusaders, and they occupied many communities briefly, say briefly, over the last century. You still go today, you can find the remains. When you go to Palestine, you will see the remains of Byzantine churches and the influence of early Eastern Christianity, and you will find the remains of Crusader palaces. Crusader castles. Some of them still standing, or remains thereof, still in pretty good shape. They just simply built medieval European castles in Palestine, and they took the Holy Land away from the Turks to preserve the holy places. However, their interest in archaeology was very limited. They were interested in identifying the holy places, but they had no basis of scholarship for doing so. They sort of accepted, when the Crusaders went there, they wanted to rescue the ancients had a superstitious, ignorant view of ancient relics. For instance, the 14th, 13th, 14th, and early 15th centuries in Europe, there were certainly all kinds of relics. There was enough wood. Everybody had a piece of wood from the cross. I'm not suggesting you put them all together, they have enough to build the ark. You could get one of Mary's teeth. One feudal lord had enough hairs from Mary's head that he sold them or gave them as gifts. You could get the knucklebone of John the Baptist, just relics, nothing about the intellectual level of their interest. And by the way, Roman Catholic Church still has it all over the world, especially in South and Central America, and in Europe, it's Portugal, Spain, Italy. You'll find hundreds of these relics, literally thousands, which of course are for the, which are 99 9/10% hokum. Nobody had a piece of the burning bush. they did not have a feather which fell from the wing of the angel Gabriel when he announced to Mary that she was going to have a child, I mentioned before. And they didn't have any Mary's teeth. And one of the relics which is possibly legitimate, possibly, in other words, possibly is the shroud. I'm going to have you. If you're reading it about that, if you read that, the current converse where the Christ shroud is going to be possible. But the cloth in which Jesus was wrapped in his burial. Now, one of the most famous relics of the Middle Ages was the cup, the Holy Grail, the question of the, about the question of the Holy Grail, and everybody had the Latin cup that Jesus used at the Last Supper. Everybody had it. claimed it. Probably nobody had it, but that was the level of historical thought in the Middle Ages. Therefore, when they got to Jerusalem, they wanted to locate the holy places. They wanted to locate the tomb of Jesus. They wanted to locate the place where he prayed, where he was placed on the cross. In this section, where Jesus was crucified, and different sites. And what they did was they simply accepted the traditional stuff, the traditional locations assigned to these, some of which possibly were sound, most of which were not. But they wanted to locate someplace, one of the places where Jesus lived and walked, or the apostles were married, where. They sort of, there was a traditional view they accepted. There was no basis of examination. They did not examine it. There was no point of comparison. There was no scholarship to undergird the examination. They had no way of finding out for sure if this really was the spot if they wanted to. But they weren't that interested. And so, even though the church temporarily occupied that site, some of the sites in Palestine, not many of them, during the Middle Ages, there was no contribution whatever made to what we call a genuine knowledge, archaeological perception of Palestine. There was interest renewed at the Renaissance, interest in scholarship, but the interest was in the form of 18th century travelers such as Pietro di Bella Valle, another famous character figure in the Old Testament, in the Renaissance period. He's the one who exposed the spurious donation of Constantine, where Emperor Constantine was supposed to have given Western Europe to the Pope because he cured him. And that was the legal fiction that supported the church's claim on Western Europe. But anyway, Pietro del, but they would, there was a, they would simply travel, they were tourists. They were tourists. And up till the main interest in Palestine, it's more the topography of the places, up to the middle of the 19th century, it was simply, many people would call it tourists. They go and they look and they would draw sketches, or later on take photographs or daguerreotypes photographs. And they, but there was not much, it was not based on any better knowledge than the Crusaders had. It contributed very little. For instance, give me an example. If you go, when you go to, and we'll talk about this later, so when you go to Palestine today, everybody waxes the emotion about Gordon's Calvary. The one outside the city. You ever been there? You know, Gordon's Calvary. Oh, Gordon. How did it was a tourist. He looked at the hill and liked it and waved it. But he was not a scholar. He was not an archaeologist. He was a tourist. Thought that'd be a good place for him to be identified or located. So he did so. Now, beginning in 1800, there began to be a greater interest in Palestine. One of the earliest, and I'm taking remember this or not, J.L. Burckhardt, a famous scholar, he's a Renaissance scholar. He discovered ancient Petra, which is down here. This is that, this is about where the line is, it was off the map. Petra, I think when we go to, maybe you think you probably go there, it's that this fortress come back in this natural canyon, a pink or rose colored rock, and they cut buildings out of the side of the rock. He became a Muslim, and was converted to the Muslim faith. And so much for Burckhardt, he located it, but that was about it. In 1838, there was a revolution in Palestinian studies. There were two scholars, an American theologian, Edward Robinson. You don't know about these two men, Edward Robinson. And he traveled for 3 months in Palestine with a pupil named Eli Smith, Robinson and Smith, Edward Robinson, Eli Smith. Now, these men were particularly well, Edward Robinson was an American theologian, but he had a German training. He had trained under Gazanius, the famous philologist, German philologist. Therefore, he had been trained in the German school of scholarship. Now, the Germans had pioneered in what we would call systematic or scientific historical studies. The Germans, for instance, the German von Ranke, for instance, who instituted this seminar system where scholars get together and they divide up a period for historians or whatever, about their subject in some way, depending on what's the historian or philosopher, whatever. And they, each one will write a dissertation or a thesis or a paper on a certain period, and he will submit it to the others, they will read it, they will analyze it. And called a seminar, and this is, you know, where you get where the systematic scientific scholarship. I know that Dr. Fogan and I can go through. We had to have four seminars. That's where you make your break yet. Yeah, you guys think you had stuff writing papers. I was like, I'd write a paper that they had a semester to write it, and you had to submit a copy to the professor and a copy to an assigned critic, and the rest of them agreed it too. They go over everything, every period, the spelling of every word, the form of every footnote, your argument, your source. They would run down your sources. Does your source really say this? Is your conclusion sound based upon what this source says? All primary sources. And then they just, so you go in, when you're writing, I get to defend it to the whole class. I've been in seminars where students' paper just disintegrated. It would not hold up. I've been in seminars where the students lose their cool and cuss out the professor. The whole semester's work is gone down the drain. They wrote a paper that would not hold up with scholarly criticism. And you don't fail the course, you get washed out of the school. You write very careful term papers. Well, this system was instituted by the Germans. Yes.
You said this was systematic scientific what?
Scholarship, or he would not simply go on, in other words, he would not simply go on traditions, if somebody, you know, or go on mythologies or whatever, he would sound scholarship. His student, Eli Smith, was strictly helpful because Smith was at home among the Arabs, who all controlled this land, of course, at this time, and he knew Arabic. He had served as a missionary for several years in Beirut, Lebanon, so he was at home in the countryside. And these two, what they did was they located many important sites in Palestine, just simply located them. This is Bethel, this is Shechem, this is Samaria. Call me? It seems very basic to us, but at that time, that had not been done on the basis of good systematic method, and this was very revolutionary. 1858 to 1863, a scholar, De Salcy, the Frenchman, worked, and he was the first modern excavator of Palestine. There was no excavation as we know it. There was tomb looting, souvenir hunting, raiding, but no systematic excavation of the site. Now, however, De Salcy didn't have enough knowledge, and there was no standard chronology, no way of dating anything. Even though he worked systematically, and the product of his work had little lasting value. In 1865, the PEF was established. 1865, the Palestinian Exploration Fund, PEF, was British. So for the next few years, British dominated archaeology in Palestine. The Palestine Exploration Fund. See, one of the problems you've got in excavation is it's extremely expensive. There are, one of the reasons archaeology is an untapped field of study is because there are so few who know how to do it, and it costs so much money to do it. The Palestine Exploration Fund, set up by the British, was a private foundation supported by philanthropic money from Britain. It, 1865 on, for the next several decades, it dominated Palestinian archaeology. One of the first ones was Charles Warren. Charles Warren dug systematically in Jerusalem. Charles Warren was his name. Now, however, again, there was no way, they had no way to date anything. They would find a piece of pottery, they didn't know where it came from. He misdated Herodian pottery. He viewed mounds as being purely natural formations. We know now that they were not. These mounds were places where ancient communities or cities or villages existed. But he thought they were just hills. He found a piece of pottery, and he'd be very interesting. You know, he would describe it, but he didn't know what it was. But he misdated it. There was no standard chronology. In 1872, two British scholars, Condor, C-O-N-D-E-R, and the famous Kitchener, did survey work. This Kitchener, by the way, do you know the story of Chinese Gordon and his death at Khartoum? There was a movie made of it by Charlton Heston, played Gordon, when he defended Khartoum during the British here in Egypt. And it was Kitchener who came to his rescue too late. Somebody said blast on the injury because they needed a hero more than they needed a victory. They let him die, something. The Kitchener is one of what came too late. But he and Condor, they did survey work again, locating sites in western Palestine. This area around in here. Yeah.
What year were they?
1872 through 78. Again, in 1870, the AES, the American Exploration Society, was set up. American Exploration Society. But they didn't do a whole lot of good. there's some survey work done, but keep in mind, there were so few, that, in other words, you didn't have any good archaeologists because there were no such thing. As we know archaeologists. These were scholars who would go out and dig. As far as method was concerned, it was haphazard. The results were very poor, some inaccurate. The man who changed all this, in 1890, the missing genius was found. 1890,
Sir Flinders Petrie. We have Sir Flinders Petrie, a Britisher, of course. He had worked for, Flinders had worked for 10 years in Egypt. He was the first man, for instance, to measure the pyramids. Began to get the system, the science. He measured the pyramids. And he had found Jewish pottery in Egyptian tombs that were datable because of written material found in the tombs. Therefore, he began to categorize certain kinds of pottery with certain dates. That is, began to identify certain forms of pottery, certain designs on the pottery, the shape of the vessel, the shape of the handle, whether it was geometric design, or there were animals or flowers or whatever it was. And he began to identify these with certain periods of history, certain eras. Well, he came to Tel El Hesi, a site in Palestine, and this was really revolutionary. First of all, he established the fundamental principle of sequence dating. It seems very simple to us, but never occurred to them. The fundamental principle of sequence dating, that is, of establishing relative chronology. He simply would dig down at a site, and maybe just dig straight down, and he simply concluded that this period represented a period, represented a time in history later than this period. The farther down you went, the older it got. So that you may not know when it was, you knew that one was earlier or older than the other. Relative chronology. Not actually, there's absolute chronology where you can fix a date. And there's the relative chronology when you may not know when it was, but you do know it was before or after something else.
Does this go off the layers of the earth? Or layers?
Yeah, layers, right, of rubble. The layers of artifacts. And, coins. See, if they dig down, they find a coin. Well, they can date it absolutely, for the most part, now. Or find a piece of pottery, they date it absolutely. But before, it's just relative. And he instituted, he got that, the principle, which seems very simple to us, of sequence dating. Secondly, the second principle, first of all, sequence dating. Second one was ceramic chronology, which simply means, you see this over there? Ceramic chronology simply means dating by pottery. What he would do, simply compared to what he found in Egypt, he said a certain kind of pottery means a certain date. Now, he was fairly accurate, too. And the third thing that he instituted was this thing of keeping records. Instead of going and digging a site, about 1870, Heinrich Schliemann, the German, had excavated Troy. And what he did was he simply moved tons of earth promiscuously looking for treasure. He found it, he found treasure, even dated it. But When Schliemann got through with the site, all you had was a hole in the ground. And there was no way of knowing, but there was no way, it was destroyed forever. He simply just moved the dirt. He'd hire over 100 workmen, they just went and just throw the dirt out, looking for what? The treasure, artifacts, man-made objects. Petrie instituted the system. As you dug down, as you removed layers, you simply made a record of what you found in each layer, so that later on you can make reference. But that's been refined a lot later. I'll talk about that later. But it's very simple. So we're going to dig this acre, and they didn't dig that much, just 100 square yards or less, and they would just record what they found, and they dug it off, and then the next level, they would probably find the earth, so that later on there'd be some. They could have some record of what was found where. For simple records, but again, the principle was there. Now, from 1890 to the next 2 years, under the TEF, Palestinian Exploration Fund, there was a lot of progress made in the refinement of methodology. Very few spectacular finds were made. Early in this period, amateurs made some brilliant amateurs would just happen on things. Really strange. One Frenchman named Charles Clermont Gounod, he found the famous Mitre Moabite stone, which is he sent to the Louvre in Paris, is still there. He also stumbled across this famous stone of inscription, which forbade the Gentiles entering the temple. And some think that Paul had referenced this particular inscription when he wrote to the Galatians that the middle wall partition between the Jews had been broken down. There was a wall with an inscription on it, but no Gentiles could go beyond this point. And he found that inscription, some other less brilliant finds. But these were amateurs, they just happened to stumble on them. Like a few years ago, some amateur stumbled on a bronze statue of Hadrian in Palestine. And the amateurs found a lot of things. But that's not really not our concern, it's just that archaeology. Now, they began, I'm going to men like R.S. McAllister and Bliss and Duncan McKenzie and others, don't worry about them, it's not, of course, not archaeology. But simply, what I want to say is that they began to dig in various places. The important progress was more in the area of refining technique or methodology than it was in what they actually found. The Germans got into the picture, and typical of German scholarship, it makes nobody who knows anything but German, they refused to learn anything from the British. What can an Englishman teach a German? Answer? Nothing. And so they ignored completely the advances that had been made by Petrie and Bliss and some others who had worked with them. And so they set out to excavate, for instance, a German called Sellen, and he worked with a man named Watzinger, who was Austrian. They excavated Jericho, they found the wall of Jericho. They ignored, let's say, the British techniques, and they dated the wall that they found there, as they labeled it as the wall which fell under the Israelite siege, late bronze wall, under the Israelite siege under Jericho. They found the wall that came tumbling down. And they published it widely. They had known it that the wall they found was about 300 to 500 years too early to be Joshua's wall. Joshua's wall has never been found. And yet, it's interesting, this was back in 1900.